Thelema, Coast to Coast, Show 35, October 27th, 2006. Do what thou wilt should be the whole of the law. Welcome to Thelema Coast to Coast. My name is John Crow, and I'm the host of the show. Before getting into the show, I want to remind listeners there are four ways to contact the podcast. First is via email, podcast@thelemacoasttocoast.com. Through the website, www.thelemacoasttocoast.com. Through the voicemail, 206-600-5782. Yes, that is a new voicemail number because, yes, I let the other one expire. It went over 30 days without receiving a single voicemail comment, and so it expired, and I had to get a new one. So, let that be a reminder to please send a voicemail. Also, the mailing address is Thelema Coast to Coast, care of John Crow, P.O. Box 7045, Marietta, Georgia, M-A-R-I-E-T-T-A. The zip code is 30065, and that's in the United States of America. In addition to those four ways that I mentioned, email, web, voicemail, and regular mail, there is a Thelema Coast to Coast MySpace page. It's at www.myspace.com/ThelemaCoastToCoast. And currently there are 1,065 friends, so thanks to everybody who joined. But I know there are more listeners out there who have MySpace pages, so please go on over to the MySpace page and request friendship, send feedback, look at the blog, leave comments. I see it all and really appreciate that. And also, if you go to the Thelema Coast to Coast website, you'll see a link to go to the Frapper map. Currently, there are 389 people listed on the Frapper map in dozens and dozens of countries. I want to welcome the listeners listening in Mexico, Portugal, Slovenia, Croatia, Russia. And I want to send a special hello to Greg Lyons in Thailand. Good luck with your vows. As this podcast is coming out at the end of October, did not have one out for Crowley Mass on the 12th, so I hope everyone had a good Crowley Mass. And speaking of not having one out earlier, yes, it's been a delay of a little over a month, and I've just really been busy. Thelema Coast to Coast comes out every 2 weeks or so. But really, it comes out when I have time and content to deliver. So sometimes it goes 3-4 weeks or more. But I do appreciate all of the emails and comments on MySpace and messages on MySpace and comments everywhere asking where the podcast is and saying that everybody's looking forward to it. So I appreciate the interest and the desire to listen to it. So here is the next podcast, number 35, so I hope you enjoy it. Going back to the voicemail, there's been less feedback than I've expected over the course of the last month. So just to remind everyone, please keep the email coming as it lets me know how I'm doing. And the emails and voicemails that I get are kind of a feedback loop that let me know how the show's going and kind of keep me motivated. So if you all are really interested in seeing more shows, send more feedback. And I'd like to request feedback that kind of addresses the show. I do appreciate the feedback that says that people are listening and that they enjoy the show, keep up the good work, etc. And that is appreciated. But I'm looking for more substantive feedback, if possible, addressing some of the issues of the guests on the show, asking them some questions that I could forward to them, or questions or comments about some of the content. So, you know, that would be appreciated too. Okay, in that vein, I did receive a couple. So the first one is from Dan Olson, He writes, "Dear Thelema Coast to Coast, do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. After listening to episode 34, I was impressed with your new, more lively approach to show hosting." Well, thank you. "Your comments and introductions were more lively than usual, which made the show more engaging in an immediate sense. I hope you continue this approach in the future. I enjoyed your interview with Keith418 for a few reasons, one of which was the sheer boldness of addressing the issue of cultishness the way you did. Why do people use the word cult? Why would, say, the OTO seem cultish be a bad thing? They're uncomfortable questions that must nevertheless be asked. I was a little disappointed that neither of you discussed what, in particular, makes Thelema and the OTO so threatening to today's culture and society. This had the unfortunate effect of giving the discussion a bit of a counter-cultural flair, i.e., what we're doing and what we stand for are so completely transgressive and confrontational that society is making an organized effort to thwart us, lest it be destroyed. An attitude elsewhere expressed about wearing long hair, smoking pot, and listening to really horrible music. What is it about Thelema that is so dangerous? What would it be? I think this is a fertile ground for discussion, and hope either you or Keith talk about it at some point. Loves the law, love under will. Dan." Thanks for the feedback, Dan. Well, Keith and I actually kind of discussed this a little in our discussion on this show. We referenced your email in particular. But, you know, the transgressive aspects, it gets a little more complex than just, you know, naysaying or just haphazardly rejecting everything that is standard in society. So I'm going to let the conversation that I have with Keith418 kind of address this email. And if that doesn't really answer your questions, please send another feedback and we'll see what we can do. The next one is from a listener named Thomas. He writes, "Greetings again, John 93, from a Canadian and regular listener. Your segment on cults and cultism was interesting." That's one drink. "The OTO is not a cult, but shouldn't be afraid of being labeled one. I spent 7 years in the Children of God, now known as the Family International, from 1976 to 1984. That was a cult. One's lifestyles and beliefs are dictated by the head of the spiritual hierarchy, both control through words, letters from the top, and peer pressure. Both local leadership and associate confirms the control. Do what thou wilt should be the whole of the law, gives freedom of expression, not tolerated in cults. The problem with the OTO, as I see it, comes from its fear of exposure. Groups that are not afraid of the cult label publish, publish, publish. The OTO should have all of Crowley's works in the stores, with contact info included. If it's really proud of Crowley's legacy, then it should be out there promoting the law Thelema and not be afraid of controversy. Again, the OTO is not a cult, and members shouldn't be worried about being perceived as members of one. 93's Tom." Well, this really is a problem, and you kind of touch on it a little with the publish, publish, publish. The OTO in the 80s and 90s, or early 90s, was very active in its publishing efforts and getting Crowley and Crowley's material out there. Over the last decade or so, they really have not made a very strong effort to do that. The last major work that came out was the astrology book for $80, and that was quite a massive tome. And but as far as I'm aware, it's not selling too well. Liber Abba, Book 4, has gone through 3 printings, but it really has kind of saturated the market. Those who are interested in it have gotten it, and those who haven't are probably not going to get it. What's worse is it's now at an $80 price, the original's coming out at $50. And the worst part is really the fact that when it first came out in the 6x9 version, it was so riddled of errors that it was quite embarrassing. So that the OTO had to come out with the 7x10 version that fixed so many errors. In fact, I think one of them even addressed the priestess as him in the mass. I mean, these kind of errors are just outrageous. So it's kind of unfortunate when those things happen. Recently, The OTL has not been doing very good about its publishing. I have a letter it sent out in the late 90s, and it says that, you know, they were going to come out with five different books, and of them, it was astrology, and it took many years after that. I remember when I was in Europe, there was talk of lots of books being published there, but they're not coming out. Germany had a lot of pirated Crowley material that the OTO effectively shut down, but the OTO is not replacing it. So Germany is becoming quite a void of Crowley's work, and so a friend of mine went to France recently and said, you know, he couldn't find any of Crowley's work in Paris, and went into occult bookshops and asked them about Crowley, and they'd never even heard of him in some cases. So it's not doing a very good job of promoting Crowley. And it could be doing a lot better, especially in English. So this really is a problem. I don't know if it's related to the being feared as being called a cult or a lot of other internal issues with production or even dedication to the ideology of or the philosophy of Thelema. So it really is a problem. The cult thing, though, is something that we need to continually look at and be concerned about and look at why people are so afraid of being called a cult. Not occult, a cult. So thanks for the feedback, Tom, and let's keep an eye on this, and I'd appreciate other feedback from people about the being called a cult within occultism. The next feedback is a voicemail feedback, so here it is.
Hi, John. I'm a listener from Los Angeles, and I really enjoy the show a lot, and I also really enjoy reading the material you have on your blog. And I am not an OTO member, but I am a Thelemite. And I do wish that they would work more to keep the books by Crowley in print. And it's a little disappointing to me that there are so many works that are unavailable to me now and that I'm forced to buy used instead of new. So thanks a lot for the hard work. I really appreciate it. Thanks.
Thanks for calling. Yeah, as I addressed in the last email, it is unfortunate that the books aren't coming out. I'm not sure what the reason is. If the OTO needs money, I don't know why it's not asking its members for more money to put out the books. If the OTO, I know the OTO is not lacking material. In fact, I know they have a number of books they could come out with. So, and they also have a bunch of books that they own the rights to that New Falcon had that they haven't republished. So I'm not exactly sure what the deal is there. Maybe someone from the OTO can send an email and let us know what's going on and why the books are so delayed. All right. The last email is a little amusing. It's from a listener named Jason. He writes, "Hi, John. Don't know if you visit YouTube much. I do occasionally. But there is an extremely popular video blog on there from a user named LonelyGirl15. It's about a 15-year-old girl and all the boring stuff that happens to her, her boyfriend, her dad. She always talks about her religion, but never said what it is. There's speculation that it is Thelema. She has symbols related to Thelema on her website, www.lonelygirl15.com. Just thought you might find it interesting." Thanks, Jason. I am familiar with the Lonely Girl 15 production that was put on. Some time ago, it was revealed that it wasn't actually real and that it was kind of an acting or online experiment. But I think it's still continuing. For those who don't know, there's this user who called herself Lonely Girl 15. She put out a bunch of video blogs on the YouTube site, and in it she makes references to her religion and ceremonies they do. She has a picture of Crowley on the wall. If you go to her website and scroll down to it, it's got a universal hexagram on it. It's got the word Thelema written in Greek, and there's lots of other references. The reality is she's not a Thelemite. The whole thing is a production, and the way they represent Thelema is completely false. She talks about things like going to summer camp. There are no Thelemic summer camps. She talks about things like doing a important ceremony at the end of a summer camp. Again, there is no summer camp, and that's not the way things operate. They talk about filming and just the crazy things that they try to represent Thelema as. It has nothing to do with Thelema. If she really was interested in Thelema and doing stuff, it would be all about what she's doing, not as a family religion. So most of the Thelemic families I know don't push Thelema down the throats of their children. What they do is they say, this is what we believe, this is what we practice, and if you choose to do this, then you're welcome to do so too, and we'll let you know how to do it, and if not, well then, do what thou wilt. That's the kind of whole point. It's not some kind of family religion that Thelema gets brought down from the parents and kind of shoved onto the children, or in this case, from Lonely Girl 15 to her The Beast boyfriend. The whole thing is completely bogus, has nothing to do with Thelema, and is just for show from people who really only know the most tangential aspects of Thelema from probably very bad books on Satanism or some of the bad books that come out from so-called Thelemic authors. So from everything that I've seen in the videos and written online and so forth, it has absolutely nothing to do with Thelema as it exists in the real world today, and only as it might for people who have no idea what Thelema's about. So, thanks for the email, Jason. Okay, so now on to the interviews. On today's show, I have an interview with the two founders of Ordo Magni Operis. They are a new occult group that was founded in Ontario about 2 years ago. I helped them edit their first book that is on their probationary degree book. So I asked them to be on the show, and so we talked about their founding, kind of what they teach and what they're all about. I'm not a member, and it's very far away from me, and they're kind of in a different direction. They're not Thelemic, but they are definitely occultic and do Western esotericism and hermetics and so forth, alchemy and so forth. So I wanted them on the show, and just so people can know that there are actually new orders actually being founded today, and kind of find out what they're doing. So I think that's a good thing to know that they're out there and to find out what they're doing. Then we have a discussion with Keith418. He and I talk about desire, equality, democracy, and we also address the transgressive aspects to some degree, and address the email from Dan. After that, I have an interview with Stephen Skinner, the well-known occult author and editor. He and I talk about his new book, The Magician's Companion. It's like 777 on steroids. It has over 800 tables on it, useful for magicians of all types, and also his other books that he's published with Golden Horde Press. So since there's a lot on this show, let's get right into it. Here is Michael and Rasputin Paracelsus from Ordo Magni Operis. We have with us Michael Paracelsus and Rasputin Paracelsus from Ordo Magni Operis. Are you there?
Yes, sir.
Yep.
Welcome to the podcast, 93.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Now, many people will have not heard of you because you're located in southern Ontario. So, can you start by giving the listeners a little history of how you all started and what was the genesis of your origin?
Okay. Michael, why don't you go with this one?
Okay. Well, we're a fairly young order, having formed we're now in our second year of operation, regular operation, and our membership is at 8, I think. So we're a fairly small order and just getting our feet off the ground, so we're going through that kind of stage. Essentially, the order formed when Rasputin and I met at a conference and started discussing and realized that we had a great deal in common with one another. And so we kind of went off and said, let's start something up. And we looked at a lot of the kind of classical systems that are currently in place and decided that while there was a certain amount of fit with most of them, they didn't quite meet our requirements completely, so we decided that we would just sort of build our own thing from the ground up. And so we've developed our own system, our own set of ceremonies, our own mythology, and let the snowball start rolling, and we're being carried along with it even as we attempt to direct it.
Now, how many founders were there?
Two. You're speaking with them.
That would be the two of us.
Oh, okay, great. And you have a third partner who came on afterwards, young Paracelsus?
Yeah, that's correct. He was initiated the year after we started.
Okay. So he's more of one of the students than actually one of the leadership of the organization?
Yeah, sort of part and part. He's the senior student, let's put it that way. So we tend to make certain types of decisions in conference. And he's contributed a certain amount with regards to suggesting materials we could use in the educational program and formats for ceremonies and things like that. So, you know, he's a sort of a junior partner, shall we say.
Okay. Now, what kind of material do you cover? You know, traditional Western esotericism is kind of a broad subject. What do you all specialize in or really concentrate on?
Well, that's a rather broad topic.
Well, I mean, are you more like Kabbalistic, Golden Dawn, Enochian? I mean, what kind of, you know, specialties?
All of those and none of those, in a different sort of sense. We have the curriculum, shall we say, layered by degrees, and so each degree focuses on some different things. In the at the entry level, we do a certain amount of discussion of traditional systems. So we talk a little bit about the Golden Dawn. We talk a little bit about Kabbalah, traditional systems, and things like that. A certain amount of ceremonial, et cetera, et cetera. But we don't get into anything in too much depth. And we concentrate on the discussion of mysticism, generally speaking, personality types, development of the personality, and we also do some introductory alchemical work, studying the basics of how alchemical emblems are put together and things like that. Then the idea is that we migrate into more traditional ceremonial things, such as, for example, Cornelius Agrippa and things like that in the first degree work, where we deal with elemental type concerns, and then astrology and the like in the second degree, and then other types of systems, whatever hasn't been covered up to that point, is relegated to the third degree.
So it's a three-degree system?
Essentially. Four, I guess, if you count the probation period.
Once somebody reaches the top of the third degree, what kind of expectations should they have about their knowledge and attainment? What, I guess I'm asking, kind of, what is the goal of the 3 degrees? Is it higher levels of consciousness? Is it more proficiency or attainment within Western esotericism? Is it some kind of religious, or what is the goal?
It was probably multiple, I guess, and we can maybe both speak to that. It isn't religious. That's the one thing we can sort of rule out from the top. We prefer to let people hang whatever own personal religious trappings they like on the system. So it's more philosophical, psychological, shall we say. So for that reason, there is a focus on personal development, individuation of the personality, and all of that on an alchemical model. That's sort of the central core. But then beyond that, people can migrate and progress in other layers. Michael can maybe talk about that better than I can.
The aim of the order, the direction of the order, is the achievement of the great work, that sort of ongoing, never-ending process of self-improvement, self-discovery. So in that respect, it's sort of the classical, universal, mystical goal, whatever that might be to each individual. And we seek to provide for our membership the tools and the environment in which they can pursue the great work, spiritual perfection, you know, immortality, health, all of that good stuff. And to that end, I guess, basically, and I guess it's sort of touching on the earlier question, we're presenting sort of the tools and the history with as much scholarship as we can provide of those who have gone before, as it were. So, you know, we'll talk about the Greeks and the Egyptians and Babylonians and medieval alchemists and modern practitioners in a variety of traditions. So, and basically allow the student to determine what it is that they are, what it is that their path is going to be, and will provide the environment by which that path can be followed.
Now, you mentioned scholarship. You both come from an academic background.
That's right.
So can within your order, do you have you might say a higher or a greater stress on an academic approach and or higher standards of material?
Yeah, I prefer not to say higher standards simply because that, you know, people could hear that potentially as a pejorative of something else. But because of the kinds of people that we are and where we come from, yes, we do have a high focus on this sort of thing. So in my secular life, I teach biblical Hebrew and culture of the ancient Near East and whatnot in a university environment. And so that has colored the order and its formation and expectations. So probationers learn a certain amount of biblical Hebrew, very, very basic grammar. So there is an expectation that people learn to be able to read and translate very simple things themselves using proper scholarly resources and the like. And we're taking a similar approach to alchemical materials and whatever. Michael, of course, has more background in philosophy, so he takes care of that end of things.
Michael, do you want to touch on that a bit? You know, what your approach to bringing the philosophical element to this?
Well, my undergraduate education is in philosophy, and I've given a bunch of lectures on a variety of topics in that area. So, I'm continuing along with that. In addition, I'm also a performer and a dramatist, so I bring the sort of more practical side in as well in terms of the actual performance of the ceremonies and that kind of thing. So the emphasis, I would say it's fair to say that the emphasis is on scholarship at this point. However, we also have a fairly heavy emphasis, quality and focus in terms of the performance of ceremonies, fairly nitpicky in terms of detail and that kind of thing.
So theoretical and practical.
Okay. Now, when you say the ceremonies, are you using traditional kind of Golden Dawn ceremonies, or are you also creating your own, or is it a combination, I would assume?
Well, mostly everything is written from the ground up. So we've looked at the various stages that we're having people go through, and we've specifically designed ceremonies from the ground up that target those purposes. So we've gone to some traditional mythological material, be it biblical, be it Babylonian, be it otherwise, and look for some motifs and whatnot, and sort of recast those in another setting with the focus of a ceremony in mind. So they're actually not Golden Dawn ceremonies or anything that would belong to anybody else. The common points would be the fact that, for example, there are pentagrams and the like, and robes and such, but it's actually not patterned on anybody else's thing.
Okay. Now, if somebody was interested in participating, would they actually have to be physically initiated in the order, or is this an order that can work through correspondence?
Thus far, it's been mostly people here hard on the ground, simply because we're in the early stages. You know, we have to build up a solid core before we can go anywhere else. However, we have put together curriculum which was offered through public lectures, and then, you know, people who are interested have stayed with us, and we've done ongoing meetings over the course of a year. And that was with the goal in mind that we could make this the book and materials available to people on a longer scale who'd then be able to do it in a correspondent sort of fashion.
Would they still be able to continue through the degrees, or would they have to at some point travel to be initiated?
At the moment, I think they would have to travel here to be initiated. That's only simply because we've got the one operating temple at the moment. We do have the hope that as people move up through the system, that we'll then be spawning some other temples in other locations, and people will be able to travel to one of those instead.
Okay. Fantastic. If people want to get in touch with you, how should they contact you?
Well, the easiest thing is through the secretary email, which is scriba@omo.org. So I can spell that out for you. scriba@o-m-o.org.
Okay. And the o-m-o.org is your website?
Yeah, that's our domain name. Yeah. The website is currently undergoing some morphs. We've switched from one system to another system, and it's there, but it's not in its fully functional form.
Okay. Well, is there anything else you all want to add?
Okay. I mean, just maybe a couple of smaller points. On the website, we do have a statement of purpose, and we're working on FAQs. We did have a full set of FAQs under the old site, and we're working on porting that over. People can certainly contact us by email, and then we can give tailor-made responses to whatever questions they have. And the book which we put out is going to undergo some corrections. There are various typos and whatnot, which, by the way, we want to thank you for your input on that. Once we've made those corrections, we'll probably make it publicly available through Lulu, and people will be able to order it for themselves if they're interested. I have a copy someplace.
I have one in front of me right now.
Oh, good. Well, you can maybe say how long it is and tell people what the chapters are.
Yeah, it's about 130 pages, and there are chapters that are it's kind of broken up into sections about the order and the program, then philosophical things like what is truth, and then psychology, and then Hebrew and Kabbalah, astrological, drama, gets into some rituals and things like that. So
there you go. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. I really appreciated the opportunity to proof it and go through and review the material. It was very interesting.
So we anticipate having the corrections to that made within the next couple of months, and probably by end of year it'll be available.
Great. All right. Well, thanks again for being on the show. And again, if anybody is interested, they should email scriba@o-m-o.org.
Thank you very much, John.
Thank you very much.
93.
Bye-bye.
I want to thank Michael and Rasputin for being on the show. Thanks for taking the time and letting us know about what you're doing up in Southern Ontario. I think it's great that new orders are being founded and new ideas are being tried out. So everybody interested, go to www.o-m-o.org. The next interview is with Keith 418. We discussed a number of aspects about Thelema. The discussion actually gets into a lot of different areas, so I'll just let you take a listen to it and let me know what you think.
We have on the phone with us again Keith 418. Welcome to the podcast, Keith. 93,
John. Thanks for having me.
In many of your online critiques, you come out against democracy and equality and seeing people as equal and so forth. Why do you do that? What isn't every man and every woman a star? Isn't, you know, what people want and their desires, aren't they all equal, and don't they all matter?
Well, they all matter. Whether they all matter in an equal way is an interesting question. I don't think my opinion about this is particularly important. I do think Crowley's opinion about these questions is important, and whenever anyone asks me about this, I point them back to his own writings about it and suggest that they explore those ideas. You know, one of your readers was asking me, for example, or you, to talk about what we found transgressive in Crowley's teaching. Do you remember that email that you got, or was a response? And my original response to that, you know, mentally was, I don't want to do their work for them. I would encourage them instead to go back through Crowley's teaching, to go back through the basic materials, and to say, what about this is offensive to modern mainstream American values? And what about this is transgressive? What does it mean to transgress? You know, I think one of the things in the occult community, a friend of mine pointed this out to me a long time ago, and I've thought about it a lot since then, is his critique of the Temple of Set is that this is a group that wants to be evil but not transgressive. What is the difference between a sort of theatrical sense of evil in a monster movie kind of way and really transgressive? And I urge people to read Michael Aquino's Temple of Set book, his history of the Church of Satan and the origins of the Temple of Set, to get an idea about this kind of conflict. What is transgressive and what is truly evil? These are interesting questions. And to me, the Temple of Set is silly because it seems to want to be evil. It doesn't really want to be transgressive. It doesn't want to transgress against the mainstream bourgeois values that oftentimes it seems to want to embrace, the sort of Rotary Club middle class respectability. And can you really be a transgressive organization and do that at the same time? And the reason I think it's interesting for us to look at is I think the OTO has a lot of the same problems. Now, one of the things that Crowley did say, and I will say this, is that he was very much opposed to the idea of equality. And this comes out over and over again in his comments on the Book of the Law and in other places. He just thought it was crap. And if people are interested in exploring this, they need to read Nietzsche, you know, first and foremost. But they also need to look at the history of American individualists and philosophers in American politics who are sort of off the beaten record, off the beaten track, people like Nock, for example, who I would recommend folks taking a look at, and others who, you know, basically say this idea of equality is meaningless. If we're all different, we all can't be equal. And the more you push equality, the more you're ultimately pushing a uniformity, which leads to a police state and conformity and a whole bunch of other things that I don't think most of the people in the OTO really want. So they're torn between this sentimental, very Christian idea of equality, which I think is rooted in Christianity and in Judeo-Christian values in general, and the idea of inequality, which expresses itself in undemocratic organizations like the OTO and the AA. I mean, both of those organizations are not based on democracies. They're based on hierarchies which are not subject to popular opinion or popular demands. And we see the conflict that this happens in the OTO frequently when people talk about what folks want. Now, I've been looking at this a lot lately where body masters will say things online like, well, what people want is a party. Well, what people want is a social activity. Well, what people want is, you know, less magic and more religion. And they don't want to do this. They don't want to learn that. And how do we facilitate that? And, you know, my response is, who cares what they want? What they want might not be what they need. What they say they want might not be what they really want. And Crowley wanted a magical revelation that was in keeping with his Buddhist values. He didn't get that. People in the OTO may want a big party, a Burning Man-like event, and that may not be what they need or what they really want or what they should have. So we need to challenge this sort of idea and value that most Americans have, that you give people what they want and the majority rules. Now, majority is not always right, and this idea that you have to give everyone what they want, it might not be true either. You know, you bring up the idea of desire, which I think is really interesting. And desire is something I think is very individualistic and is something that people really need to sort of hone and figure out for themselves. And I don't think most of the people in the OTO are really honest about what they desire on a deep level. I don't know if they experience what they desire. I don't know if they can articulate it. And one of the things that I always liked about approaches in the 80s and some of the stuff that went on regarding new ways of working with the Austin and spare material was that it forced people to come up with an alphabet of desire. It forced people to scrutinize what their desires really were and to be honest about them. And that's not something that I think consumer society really encourages, because you can't market to that effectively.
What about the fact that individual experiences, or that people should be striving for individual experiences with the HGA, and that the HGA, how does that relate to kind of what people want as a majority?
Right. Well, again, I mean, it's impossible to speak to that sort of question in really general terms. I think what's better is for people to start to look honestly at what they desire and to hone and give expression to their deepest desires and the things that they really, really want, and to come to terms with those issues and to face them.
Okay,
and
well, what if the local process, body desires to have a party in a Burning Man situation and not do work? Or what if
that's
all they
desire? If the body as a whole may want to do that, then they may decide that they aren't really interested in the Blue Equinox OTO or in Crowley's teachings about discipline and everything else. I mean, there's nothing wrong with parties, provided it's balanced against the other stuff that's there. That's my understanding of his teaching, is that there's a place for social activity within the organization, but that the organization's purpose isn't supposed to be subordinated to that. And when you bring this up with people, they're like, well, that's not what people want. They want this. I mean, for example, you know, I talk to people all over the country who are very unhappy with the way local bodies de-emphasize magic and Crowley. I was talking to somebody today who was just appalled by it. And the attitude when you challenge people about this is, well, that's not what people want. Well, okay, the people who do want that may be alienated by the people who aren't really interested in Crowley or the Blue Equinox OTO or Thelema at all, and are just there to have a party and meet other weirdos, you know, or other fat people that they can be friends with because they're lonely and fucked up.
Right, and don't drug addicts, what they want are drugs, even though it's not good for them, or little children want to eat cake and ice cream all the time?
Exactly, exactly. So the idea that what everybody wants and what the majority wants is automatically legitimate, I think, has to be questioned. And if you start doing that, that's transgressive. You know, the whole idea here is what really transgresses against the values that we have. And that's what I would ask people to carefully examine the Crowley material and see the stuff that, if taken seriously, what is going to make, you know, the average functioning middle class member of American consumer democratic society freak out. And if they're honest with themselves, they will see that there's a lot of transgressive material in the Crowley corpus. You know, one of the things that came up recently was that a friend of mine was asking me some questions about Crowley's writing, and I referred them to the Boggy Mawadar, The Scented Garden.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a, you know, PDF of it online somewhere, or they found a copy of it, and they were freaked out. And they said, why doesn't anyone talk about this stuff? The book is out of print. It was not published by the OTO to begin with. It was published by Titan Press. And I said, well, this is disturbing to people. This has got a lot of material in it that frightens them. And I'll never forget, you know, one conversation I had with an OTO leader. I brought up Leia Sublime, and he said, I wish Crowley had never written that poem. Now, why would somebody be motivated to say that about Crowley's writing? Why would they say, I wish he hadn't written that?
Right, because it's something they have to reckon with, and they would prefer not to.
Right, it makes them unhappy. It transgresses against their safe, nice, happy, happy values.
Well, but the problem is, the HGA is not a safe, nice, happy, happy being.
But
it says things that are transgressive.
Right, but they want it to be. I see this with people all the time. I think one of your guests was, at one point, was talking somewhere about how his HGA was his imaginary friend from childhood. So he didn't have to do any of that arduous work to discover his HGA because it was always there. It was, you know, his imaginary friend. You know, done deal. And well, what is your imaginary friend when you're a little kid going to tell you? I mean, not very many of them talk like IWAS does or say things that are going to challenge you to the extent that Crowley's HGA experience challenged him. And I think a lot of people are hoping that their HGA experience is going to replace all the stuff in the Book of the Law and in all the other Kalimic books that they don't like and give them something that's going to make them happy. And Crowley's experience with his HGA was not a happy-making thing for him. He rejected it. He struggled against it. It caused him a huge amount of problems. One could say it was a curse as much as it was a blessing. Well, who in the OTO is running around saying, I've got my HGA experience, and yeah, it's a tremendous pain and very difficult for me and something I have to struggle and fight with? No, it's for them, it's a ratification and a legitimization of all of their pre-existing desires, wants, and values, which, when examined, turn out to be totally dictated by the metaphysics of the previous aeon. It's all just secular humanism, liberalism, and everyone's equal, and we're all happy, and it's this hippy-dippy, you know, the temporary autonomous zone kind of nonsense. So I have no respect for that. I mean, if people think that's challenging and interesting and makes them happy, good, fine for them. I think it's a pile of poop. And I think that the, you know, middle-class leaders of the OTO who don't challenge people and don't look at this stuff and see it as being transgressive and important are losers and are just, like, missing out on the whole point of it. I don't think they get it.
Well, hold on one second. There, and some of the things that I've been studying that and this kind of goes back with the last guest, with Tantra, that there are these two paths that are developing in systems that have a kind of a sutra basis and a tantra basis. And the sutra basis is kind of like the, if you'll look at Crowley's writings like Liber 101, the Blue Equinox stuff. You know, this is the system, this is the rules, this is how you do it. And then on the other side, you have the transgressive material where it's like about breaking the rules, about breaking the norms, about breaking all of these things. And so you have this balance that the individual has to work out to figure out where things are and where they are within these two trends, within the institutionalization and within the anti-institutionalization. And what we see is a lot of the leadership stressing so much the institutionalization part, but not even considering the transgressive tantric part.
There may be some utility to making that division. I question it at a certain point, but let's just say for the sake of argument that there is utility in making that division. The question then becomes, you know, they look ridiculous by just clinging to the one and rejecting the other. And you know, my experience has been that the people who devote themselves purely to one system or the other are are idiots. That they, the pure tantric people who go around insisting that there can't be any system never get anywhere because they reject the very things that could help them advance. And in the same thing is true for the people who reject the Tantra and think that they can develop this empty formalist religious system without any of the nasty parts. And they're both stupid and they both don't get anywhere. They both don't get anywhere in different ways, but the result is ultimately, I think, the same of nothingness and nihilism. And it's tricky because the nihilism of the Tantra only people is a little bit more obvious. But you and I have seen that when people just devote themselves to the empty formalism that the current OTO is heading towards, the nihilism is the same. I mean, it's the same crises, the same lurching from crisis to crisis, the same problems. So it ends up being nihilistic anyway, even if it's not immediately as apparent. But, yeah, you have to have both, and, you know, you have to be able to balance them. And I don't criticize the OTO for being anything but out of balance. I mean, balance is the key word a lot of bourgeois occultists use to sort of create a safety place for themselves. And in fact, the current OTO, I think, is way out of balance. That it's gone over completely towards something that will make nice, comfortable, middle-class people feel safe and warm and give them what they want, which is a sense of serenity, a sense of peace. I don't know, you and I were talking about an article criticizing American Buddhists for what they wanted out of Buddhism, and it was a happy place. They
Right.
wanted calm. They wanted serenity. That's not what religion is about. It's not giving you a happy place.
Nor is it what Buddhism is about. I mean, if you go and look at so many of the aspects that the Buddha set up and the rules, the vijnana and everything, they're anything but happy-making. You can only eat from when you wake up in the morning till, you know, noon. You can't eat after that. You can't do all of these other things. There are more than 400 restrictions put on a monastic Buddhist. That's not happy-making.
Well, it's not happy-making for people who don't want discipline. I mean, and then, again, we're back to this thing of, well, people want a party. You know, well, the 9-year-olds want ice cream. Does that mean we give it to them? No. And I would also argue, and I've been arguing, that the parties suck because everyone is so undisciplined and boring and unchallenging. If you want to have great parties, and I'm not opposed to having a great party, I think the great parties only happen when you have really smart, really intelligent, really well-disciplined people who study the material and are really enthusiastic about it. Those are the parties I want to go to. I don't want to go to a bunch of parties with fat, stupid, uneducated, not curious, you know, lazy OTO people who can't get anything done and are boring and not interested in the material. Who wants to hang out with those people? I don't want to hang out with them.
They have nothing interesting to say or do.
No, they have nothing interesting to offer. And that's the problem. We're not opposed to a party. We just want to party with people who know how to party well. And knowing how to party well involves, I think, being intelligent, being interesting, and having something to share and having something to contribute. So, again, people, if they go back to the original material and really ask themselves, if I took this seriously, what would this mean? They will find the transgressive elements there for themselves. You and I won't have to tell them what they are. But I will say that if you identify the values of middle-class life in America as it's lived right now and start applying the lima to it rigorously, you'll see there's a lot of transgression there. There's more than enough to keep people occupied.
All right, well, I think that's a good place to stop. So thank you again for being on the podcast, and 93,
John, thanks for having me.
The last interview I have is with Stephen Skinner. The sound quality is not the best. Stephen Skinner lives in Asia, so he and I had a long-distance call, literally halfway across the globe. And so the sound is not the best, but I still think the interview is well worth dealing with the sound. He's full of information. His background talks about the books, what has come out through Golden Horde, how the Magician's Companion came together. And then also he talks about the next book that's going to be coming out through Golden Horde. So here's Stephen Skinner.
We have on the phone with us Stephen Skinner. Welcome to the podcast, Stephen.
Hi, John.
For those who are not aware, you've been in magic and magical practice and writing about magic for over 30 years. How did you get into the practice of magic?
Well, in fact, I've been involved in magic since the early 60s, and originally I got involved with a group which was doing tarot studies in Sydney, And that led very rapidly to initiation into a working lodge there. And so I was lucky to have been involved before I was 16, in fact.
So you have been practicing magic since you were 16?
Yep. In fact, I also managed to get to university before I was when I was 16 as well. So I guess I was a bit precocious in those days.
It would seem so. Now, your first book on magic, how did that come about?
Well, the very first one I did was called Search for Abraxas, and that was done with Neville Drury. And Neville just came across to London and was looking for a publisher, and he found Neville Spearman. And I think Neville Spearman, just more or less to get rid of us, said, oh, if you can write the book in a month or so, I'll publish it, thinking we couldn't do that. So we sat down and did that, and then he had to honor his promise. So that was the first book. But I suppose the one that's most known is Techniques of High Magic, which I did with Francis King in the 1970s.
How did you get introduced to Francis King and work on that magic book?
Well, I was brought up in Sydney. Francis lived in London. When I first came to London, by that time, I guess it was through mutual acquaintances. In fact, I think it was Stuart Farrow who introduced me to Francis first off. And we got on quite well and decided to do, in fact, a couple of books together.
Mm-hmm.
Francis, alas, has now passed on. Unfortunately, he never wrote an autobiography, which would have been one of the more amusing books about magic.
Right. Now, are you a practicing magician, or do you go towards more a pagan or witchcraft path?
No, magic has always been my interest.
Okay.
I'd like to draw a bit of a line there. Paganism is fine, but is concerned perhaps more with religious practice, because you're dealing just with the gods. Witchcraft, modern witchcraft, came into prominence with Gerald Brusso Gardner and Cecil Williamson during the 40s and 50s. And although I've known most of the people like Alexanders who were involved in propagating that, I never got actively involved myself. My interest has been more of the medieval ceremonial and grimoire magic.
How did you get involved with Feng Shui, since you've written 20-some books about it?
There are two answers to that. The one I usually give is that I had a friend who had a legal practice in Hong Kong, and his practice needs a little bit of help. And jokingly, I think he went off and got a feng shui man to help reorganize his office. And so I met that feng shui master way back in the mid-70s and learned the practical side of feng shui before I ever understood the theory of it. So I suppose I learned my feng shui backwards. The other route leading into that was a spin-off from Techniques of High Magic, where I did a couple of books on geomancy. Geomancy, as most people listening to this will know, is a Western and Arabic form of divination using dots tied to the earth. But some unfortunate missionary in the late 1870s used the word geomancy to translate the word feng shui out of Chinese. And so when I was working on those books on geomancy, I came across a lot of feng shui and 19th century books, and I got fascinated. And then the two things came together because my profession originally was geography lecturer. So I was fascinated that utilizing the geography of the land, you could actually alter the fortunes of people living in the houses there. So all those three strands came together, and that's why my interest in feng shui.
Now, feng shui is about the movement of the qi. How do you think those concepts of energy movement mesh with the concepts of energy manipulation and magic? Do you think there's a lot of overlap there?
Yes and no. Feng Shui deals with fairly concrete forces. Qi is something which I think it's only a matter of time before it'll be measurable in some way or another. You can get pretty predictable feng shui results by doing just specific formulaic things. My view on magic, however, is that you are dealing not with abstract forces, but you're dealing with entities. And these entities are a lot more individual than the energy that feng shui deals with.
So you're saying that you see the angels or demons or however they're described, these entities, as definitive, external, discrete units versus the idea of their psychological projections?
No. I don't buy the psychological projection for various reasons, to a large extent from practical experience, but also because the idea that they are psychological projections was probably started by Crowley as a way of justifying his work with the Gaurisha. In fact, I think in his introduction to the Gaurisha, he even suggested they're parts of the brain, which is something I don't think anybody would think now. And then psychology, particularly in the works of Carl Jung, seized upon mythology and alchemy and other related technologies and started to interpret them in a psychological way. However, my take on what I like to call spiritual creatures, that is, entities like demons, angels, nature spirits, is that they do have a discrete existence, and they have been labeled at various stages in the history by, I suppose, predominantly Christian commentators. So that, for example, to draw a parallel, if you visited the zoo and you were looking at animals you'd never seen before, you might categorize the contents of the snake house as rather demonic and the contents of the aviary perhaps as angelic. But basically, you are still looking at individual animals, which I suppose in a weird sort of way, I think that Dee's description of them as spiritual creatures and his assertion, which I find to be quite true, that you can't always tell the difference between a demon impersonating an angel and an angel, is uncomfortable and difficult, but basically correct.
Well,
I don't know whether that makes enough sense.
No, I think that's fine. Let's move into your more recent publications with Golden Horde. Now, you have three books with Golden Horde so far. The first came out a few years ago. It was one that you also wrote with David Rankin.
Yes.
And that was called The Practical Angel Magic of Dr. John Dee's Enochian Tables. Why did you start with that book?
For those of you who know my history, you'll know that I've always been interested in Dee's work. And in fact, in the early 70s, I spent almost an entire year just reading all of his original manuscripts in the Bodleian and the British Museum, as it was called then, but now it's called the British Library. And I constructed a synthesis of that, of all of that work, which unfortunately was never published for other complicated reasons. But one of the bits that I didn't work on then was the 17th century development of Dee's work. In other words, after Dee died in 1608, what actually happened to his invocations and his systems of magic? Well, normally these days most people think that they just popped up again when Mathers did the research for the Golden Dawn. But in fact, there's a definitive hand-me-down structure of ritual angelic magicians working with these entities over the period of the 1600s, right through the 1700s and into the 1800s. And it's in the 1800s that workers like Fred Hockley got hold of this material, and then some of it, but only a portion of it, came into the Golden Dawn. Hockley was very strong on scrying and using the crystal. So this tradition is quite solid, and I named in that book the various magicians who handed on from one to the next, and they were quite prominent people in their own right, the work on this. And so the first volume in the Golden Horde series of ceremonial magic texts was this one. It also corrects the record, if you like, of what was actually in the main table, angelic table, which in fact is on the cover. When the Golden Dawn was working with that, it had various different letters in each square, each being corrections on the previous one, and both Masters and the Guardian, his Golden Dawn, treated them as if they all were in the square. In fact, each square only carries one letter, and so the definitive table, which was rewritten in Sloan 307, forms the centerpiece for the first Golden Horde book on these Enochian magic.
Okay. The second book moves into Solomonic magic, mm-hmm. and with the Solomonic archangels and the demon princes. What was your background on that one, or why did you bring that one out next?
Well, although John Dee is usually looked upon as pretty whiter than white and always prefaced his operations with long and pretty tedious prayers, in fact, he's part of the same grimoire tradition. And, of course, the most famous of the grimoires is the Key of Solomon. So this tradition is often referred to as Solomonic. And it does date back to Hebraic or Jewish, if you like, magic of the Middle Ages and earlier. And dates right back to the Testament of Solomon, which was probably written in about the 2nd or 3rd century A.D., and it's one of the most interesting catalogues of spirits, and I've listed that in the Complete Magician's Tables at length. And from that and similar material, each of the grimoires has taken its list of spirits, and I got fascinated with the hierarchy of these and the fact that individual spirits have different qualities, carry out different attributes, have different powers. And so we thought, David and I, that we should put out a book which contained a lot of this material from the 17th century, which had never been previously published. In a way, it's an effort to sort of fill in the gaps and show that there really is a real magical transmission from working magician to working scholar magician. Rather than the sort of history of magic which implies that it was all passed down through the Rosicrucians or groups or whatever. Magic is a much more solitary occupation than that. And the idea of working magic in large groups with a Masonic framework really is a late 19th century idea. Before that, you would have a handful of people working together doing the various functions inside the circle to evoke a demon, a spirit, or an angel. And the two most common ways of evoking were either into a glass receptacle or a crystal ball, where they could be visually spotted by either a scryer or sometimes all of the members working, or externally outside the circle into a triangle, as in the Goetia. And sometimes these methods are mixed, and both avenues are offered to the evoked spirit. Sometimes it takes one and sometimes the other. But we thought that the perspective on this material was a bit limited. People were still sort of looking at the Middle Ages, and then suddenly there's a jump to Agrippa and then another jump to the Golden Dawn. So we wanted to fill in the gaps.
What has the response been to a lot of this?
Terrific. One of the responses to the D was that several people wrote and said that they'd wished that I'd put out the book that I'd originally planned, which is what I wrote back in the 1970s when I was reading Dee's manuscripts, which melded his entire system together and explained the connections. And indeed, I wish I'd put that out, but that's no longer an option. And so we'd opted for the development of the system over the next 100 years after Dee's death. And I think for a lot of people, this is quite an eye-opener. And they can see that the various techniques explained in that century, which is used by working magicians who were actually getting results, quite good results, which people are not aware of now. When I say results, there's a number of records of practice where you see noted down by the various members of the groups in that time, either very very strong poltergeist phenomena, visual phenomena, manifestation, and then various other effects, the sort of thing which you do not get in, say, a Golden Dawn Temple operation.
Okay. Now, before we get into the complete magician's tables, there's a third book planned in the series called The Goetia of Dr. Rudd, Angels and Demons. When is that coming out?
Well, it's been delayed a little bit because of the work on the complete magician's tables. It's planned for late November at the moment. There's been a lot of interest in this. When David and I first discussed bringing out another edition of the Goetia, we both said, well, there are so many different editions of the Goetia, why should we bother? And indeed, the best standard edition is that brought out by Joseph Peterson, which is what anybody should look at if they just want to look at the details of the manuscript of the Goetia and the four or five constituent books inside it. But what the Goetia doesn't do in those manuscripts is explain how, because the people who used the manuscripts in the 17th century knew how, and therefore that wasn't written down. So, for example, the very first word at the front of one of the manuscripts of the Goetia is the word Shemham Forash. It refers to the 72 angels whose names are generated from a passage in Exodus. And these 72 angels have been used for a long time as on a specifically one-to-one basis to control the 72 demons of the Goetia. The problem is that the person who transcribed the Goetia simply put one word to indicate how it was done. And so, with nothing else, because it's a long tradition that individual angels have control over individual demons. This tradition, in fact, goes back to, and almost certainly before, the Testament of Solomon, where in the tables that I've done in Complete Magician's Tables, it specifies which angel controls which of the demons. Without that knowledge, just calling up a demon ad hoc is either going to not work most of the time, or it might even be dangerous. You need to know what the lever is to get it to work, and I think a lot of people nowadays do not know that. So our plan in publishing Dr. Rudd's Goetia is to publish his version of the text of the Goetia, which differs from the standard text in a number of respects. The first respect is that Dr. Rudd expands upon that single word, Shemham Forash, and explains how and where to use and which angel to use in the procedure. In our introduction, I've explained also the technique for using it and why some of the drawings that just occur without any explanation in the standard edition of the Goetia, how they're used. And this is not speculative. This is from the records of working magicians at the time. So I can say exactly, for example, the seal, Solomon's seal, which was used on the brass vessel, which he sealed the demons into, has a specific ritual use and so forth. None of this is explained in the standard edition of the Goetia. So that's why we did it, to take not merely the text, but to explain how to use it based on work which was done in the 17th century and indeed work that's been repeated in the 20th and 21st century.
Fantastic. Let's move into the Complete Magician's Tables. Now, this is kind of a break in your series, but I see as a hugely important reference book. It's just so full of information. I was kind of overwhelmed when I started looking at it. Why did you feel the necessity to create this?
Well, there's, again, several answers to this. I think the first answer is that the amount of tabular information around at the moment is increasing. But if you look back at Crowley 777, it's basically quite hard to use because in Crowley 777, he's just listed the tables in probably the order they were taught in the Golden Dawn. But they seem very random, without explanation. For example, the first four tables in that book, the first four columns, rather, are all in Hebrew. And there's only one column amongst the first four that's actually in English. And this is not really the way that you want to start reading a book, particularly if you don't read Hebrew. So I thought that if these were rearranged and if all of the background material was brought in as well, so that you knew where they came from, that would be a much more useful reference. And the second reason is that in going through all this Goetia magic and indeed in using it, one of the key things that you need is the correct names of the entities you're working with, because the names are very important. And these occur nowhere in tabular form. So we thought that, I thought that that would be worth doing. And then examining Crowley's method of laying them out on the tree, it was obvious that there are a number of different ways of designing the Tree of Life, and that the one that the Golden Dawn used only really dates back to the time of Athanasius Kircher, early in the 1600s. And it was Kircher who, because he didn't know the order of the powers, simply decided to number them from the top going downwards. So it's always down and right down the tree to number them. And this is the past numeration which is stuck in, I suppose, Western esoteric tradition. In fact, it is much more useful to go back to the original Kabbalistic and Hebrew version, which depends upon the Sefer Yetzirah, which probably dates back to about the 3rd century AD, and its content certainly a lot earlier. And in that, it very clearly breaks down the Hebrew alphabet into three sorts of letters: the mother letters, which relate to the elements, the double letters, which relate to the planets, and the single letters, which relate to the zodiacal signs. And so if you use the Tree of Life from original Hebraic sources, it's quite different from the Golden Dawn one. And therefore, I thought it was useful to, instead of using the Golden Dawn tree to lay out the knowledge, that one just simply tabulated according to the planets, the elements, and the zodiac. And the very pleasing result of that is that a lot of correlation suddenly becomes very obvious, which it wasn't previously. And so I pulled most of the well-known grimoire material in, quite a lot of Enochian stuff, which obviously that's a passion of mine. Also material from the Jewish, the Islamic, and the Christian background, which is necessary because all of these religions have dealt with angels and spirits at some point. And then, of course, the temptation was overwhelming to bring in material on feng shui and Chinese Taoism, one of the other areas which I've never written on, but which I have some experience of, is Taoist magic. That's probably a whole different conversation, but I tabulated some of the spirit tables from Taoist magic. And then, thinking about astrology, although astrology has been written up in an awful lot of ways, it's a long time since anybody's ever written astrology up as it was relevant to the magician. So I looked back and reproduced a lot of that in tabular form, because although nowadays astrology is very concerned with individual delineations of one's birth date, in the past astrology was concerned with more universal things. The appearance of a new star was thought to herald a new political or religious movement. In fact, the bright star that shone over Bethlehem is reputed to have issued in Christianity. But on a much more micro scale, individual changes in the heaven, the position of the moon in the different mansions of the moon, position of the sun, and major conflicts and aspects had a very strong effect on magic. And so it's important to know these things from a magician's point of view, because it then gives you the times when you are most likely to have considerable success and times when work will be a little uphill. So those are all tabulated in magician's tables. And so the book began to grow, and even looking at the Kabbalistic material, it became obvious that this needed to be looked at from the point of view of the different trees, and also the names of God and of the spirits and the four different worlds have never really been put out in a very logical way. The other thing that I put in there was an extended correlation between the various different alphabets, like the Arabic alphabet, the Latin alphabet, the Hebrew, Coptic, and so forth, touched upon by Crowley in 777, but done in much greater detail in the Complete Magician's Tables. And, it just grew from there. You mentioned paganism earlier. It was quite a challenge to try and correlate a lot of the different pagan families of gods. And I know that section could be amplified considerably, but I certainly had fun doing it, and it provides a basis, hopefully, for many of the pagan theologies. One thing I personally found lacking was a timeline which included all the major magicians, alchemists, and Kabbalists, and so I'd done that in one of the tables, so that you can easily look up who came before who. And I've tried to include even quite obscure magicians and Kabbalists who were important because they were actually practical, and I've left out some of the people commonly thought to be associated with magic, like, for example, Gilles de Rais, who was probably more of a mass murderer than a magician. And other people who've been of interest sort of in pretty casual histories of magic but didn't actually make any contribution to the subject itself. And then the emergence of people being aware of Greek gematria I thought was worth reinforcing with a couple of pages of the most important Greek gematria, particularly of the gods and words of power used in the early Greek magical manuscripts. And then an expansion on the I Ching and a new way of looking at that. I think Crowley's correlation of the I Ching with Western magic suffers because his appreciation of the Chinese Taoist background to the I Ching I don't think was sufficiently adequate for the job. So I hope I've provided some more information there. And then, having done that, it became necessary to write some kind of a commentary because a lot of the material is new, and lo and behold, the book grew to well over 400 pages and more than, I think, just on 800 tables. And so we published it. And that's really how it came about.
Right. And just for people who haven't seen it, you do retain a lot of the... You have a column often that refers to the paths and the other kind of order that is in 777, and you also include the column numbers when appropriate from 777. So there is some cross-referencing in here.
for individuals who are...
A lot of cross-referencing. The idea being that if you take issue with anything that I've put there, you can very rapidly cross-check it back against a Golden Dawn version or something else. Obviously, the many, many columns that are new, because I think Crowley did only about 180 columns in 777, whereas Complete Magician's Tales has about 800 columns. The many columns that are new don't cross-reference back, but in the commentary, I've tried to note where the sources were so that people can check it against original material if that's what they want to do.
Right, and that's the other thing that I find kind of fascinating. There's a lot of different ideas floating out there, but you used mostly older manuscripts to compile this information.
Yes.
And when there was a difference between the manuscripts, especially in the various lists of the angelic names, you created different tables for each manuscript, saying this manuscript gives this list and this manuscript gives this list.
Yeah, I suppose that comes from my training, which was originally as a lecturer. I was an academic, and so I felt that it was necessary to lay it all out. Some people might find that a bit tedious, but rather than taking material and just blending it all together, I've instead shown where it comes from. So, I mean, one notable example is the one of the most interesting lists of demons comes from Franz Baden's Practice of Magical Evocation. And in assembling that into a tabular form, it became obvious that many of the spirits came from other sources. So I tracked some of them down, and it's extraordinary that some spirits come from enciphered star names. Others come from the 72 Shemham Mephorash angels, and some are taken straight from Abramelin. So where I can, I've indicated the source of this material so that people can make their own decisions. I prefer the material which comes from working magicians and also the earlier stuff if I can find it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been the policy all the way through. So I suppose a lot of New Age or newer material from the 20th century has not been included, because I feel that if it hasn't been used practically or hasn't been around for a while, that it doesn't have the same validity as the names of planetary spirits that were used 2,000 years ago, 200 years ago, and 2 years ago, and still work.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, you've included some interesting tables, like you have a large section on Christianity where you have like the levels of hell from Dante's Inferno and the doctors of the church listing saints, things like that. Why did you feel it was useful to include that kind of material?
Well, I attempted to cut it out entirely, but the thing about the Western tradition is that a lot of it has been filtered through Christian commentaries. So, for example, although a number of Gnostic texts have survived in the Nag Hammadi collection or in the Dead Sea Scrolls, the commentaries on them and the descriptions of their basic doctrines come from the early church fathers. Now, it's not always a good idea to consult the enemy about the quality of some of a religion they're trying to suppress, but sometimes that's the only sources. So I thought to be even-handed, it's worth listing the doctors of the Christian Church. Also, angelology perhaps has flourished quite a lot under Christianity, and so that was worth mentioning. And the other bits of Christianity, like the geography of hell, which is from Dante, which you mentioned, it's fascinating because references in the grimoires tie back to Dante, and you can see that people have used his geography sometimes. So that was worth putting in. And then the most controversial thing, I suppose, is the list of saints. And I devoted a couple of pages to them because some of the saints actually probably cover other entities, and also the Catholic idea of praying to saints in some way crosses over with some forms of magical practice. But yes, perhaps if I taught again, I would cut that section out. But then it seems silly that most of the readers will come from a culture which has been heavily Christianized, and so it's useful to know where the boundaries are. Likewise, the section on Judaism, because, of course, the Kabbalah, which is the backbone of ceremonial magic, springs from Judaism, so it's worth listing some of that material. And also, there's a small section on Islam, because Islam has also dealt with the archangels, which are common to all Middle Eastern religions. The other thing that struck me when I was putting this together is that, very strangely, the three largest monotheistic religions all sprang up in the same stretch of desert between, say, Mecca and Jerusalem. And the rest of the world, almost without exception, has produced polytheistic religions. So in my subject grouping, I've grouped those three religions together. And then in the polytheistic section, I've looked at Taoist gods. I looked at Buddhist practices, also at Hindu practices, trying to correlate the different sorts of yoga and the different spiritual experiences which can be obtained using yoga. And so religion does overlap with magic and therefore forms part of the tables that a magician may wish to consult.
Mm-hmm. The section of the zones of the body, mind, and spirit is a... was kind of surprising to me on how you combined the very disparate elements. In this section, you have everything from acupuncture, meridians, and things related to, you know, your Chinese Taoism background, then Kabbalistic parts of the soul, Egyptian parts of the soul, all of these aspects. What was your... logic, or what was your idea about this section and pulling all of these things together?
Okay. So, originally, it became obvious that the spiritual anatomy of man, or the subtle anatomy of man, is quite important in magic. The use of the astral body, the use of some talismanic techniques connected with the etheric, and so forth. So I thought it was necessary to tabulate how people had divided up man's souls and spirits. And so the table starts with the Egyptian parts of the soul, and the Egyptians had quite a complicated way of doing it. And in fact, there I've been forced to list three traditional authorities on it. And then I've, in the table Z16, I've put what I consider to be the breakdown now. So the reader has four possibilities there. There has always been, in the Kabbalah, a lot of speculation about the makeup of the soul, which the Ruach, for example, is the intellect, the nefesh is the animal, the astral soul, and so on. So I put the original Hebraic words there, plus their translation and their interpretation. So those are sort of obviously part of the tradition. Less obvious is the Hindu parts of the soul, or the way Raja Yoga divides the soul up. And here, a lot of this material filtered through to the Golden Dawn via the world's theosophy, where terms like the astral plane and so forth were bandied around by the Golden Dawn, Diane Fortune, and so forth. So I thought it was necessary to tie these back into some table so they could be compared with each other. So there's a set of four columns comparing and contrasting the theosophic and Hindu parts of the soul. And then coming down a little bit grosser to the actual body itself, the energy that flows through the acupuncture meridians, which is qi, which is also the energy which is relevant to feng shui, I thought if I can tie that back into a Western categorization, then that might be useful. And indeed, it worked out quite easily. It correlated, first of all, to the 12 earthly branches of Chinese Taoist philosophy, and then they correlate back to the 12 zodiacal signs. So I didn't resist the temptation, and I put in the Chinese acupuncture meridians and their qualities as to whether yin yang or metal, earth, fire, water, wood, etc. And then the most difficult bit was probably looking at the various versions of the Sefiot Zira, where there's no clear agreement on what the attributions are. So I placed two sets of attributions in there. So from one point of view, you could say that this is not really part of the magician's armory, but from another point of view, the magician obviously deals with the subtle parts of the body as well as the external universe, and therefore that's useful to have around.
If somebody wanted to get in touch with you, how would they do so?
There's the website for Golden Horde Publishing, which is www.goldenhorde.net, and Horde is spelled like treasure, H-O-A-R-D. The idea behind the name being that we hoped to publish some valuable treasures which people would find useful. And if you wanted to look at the work that I've done in the past, then my site is www.sskinner, so that's SSKINNER.com, and that has material on both my magical interests and also my feng shui interests.
Excellent. And also, the Complete Magician's Tables are being released. It's being released in two formats. One, just a regular hardback cloth covered, and the second is a limited edition signed leather bound. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. The regular edition, or both of them, come in at 432 very large and packed pages. The regular edition retails for £30 in the UK, or $46 in the US. At present, the only edition to be released in the US is the limited edition, which is signed full leather and limited to only 250 copies. And that, I think, is $164, quite a lot more expensive, but hopefully quite rare in times to come. The main release of the Complete Magician's Tables in the US will happen later in the year. The book's available in the UK at the moment, or if you're in a bit of a hurry, then you can order it direct from www.goldenhorde.net, and we will supply it by email direct to you.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much for being on the show. I think this is a fantastic tool. I was really excited to see it, and I'm so happy that you were able to come on the show. Perhaps when the next book in the series comes out, we can talk again.
I'd be delighted to. Thank you.
Thanks. 93.
Thanks to everyone who was on the podcast. I know there was a delay, so I hope everybody has enjoyed this one. I hope the next one should come out in 2 to 3 weeks, and I get back to my regular schedule, although November is going to be a very busy month for me, so we'll see what I can do. Anyway, the closing music is from a band called Inner Surge. This is one that found me on MySpace and linked to me, and I checked out their music, and I really liked some of it. The closing song I'm going to be playing is called Wolves. They have a variety of music. They play everything from kind of a Tool sound to metal to punk. It's quite varied. And this is the song that I really like. There were some other ones I was considering. This is from their album Signals Screaming. Their website is www.innersurge.com. And I'll link to it in the show notes. So I hope you all like it. And in the meantime, thanks for listening, and I hope you stick around for the next podcast. Love is the law. Love under will.
stare in silence, supported violence. It's cargo as a human.